As a father of five amazing kids, I've had my fair share of shopping for baby gear. This is why I'm really excited to host Thomas Hamilton, the VP of Sales and Marketing at Snugglebugs, a leading baby gear retailer in Canada. I'm really impressed with Thomas' journey in the e-commerce industry, with his diverse background ranging from digital marketing, agency work, to his influential role in e-commerce. Thomas offers a unique perspective on the baby gear industry. We're going to chat about everything from the evolution of the baby industry, especially with all the changes we've seen lately, to the nitty-gritty of moving from offline to online retail. We've also dived into how Snugglebugs managed their huge product range and kept up with customer needs, especially during challenging times. We've discussed Snugglebugs' strategies in handling the surge in online retail, the crucial balance between online and offline presence, and the intricate process of managing large product inventories and customer relations. Furthermore, we'll cover Thomas' insights on leadership and team dynamic in a fast-growing company, emphasizing the value of people-driven success over automation. Thomas sees his management role as removing obstacles and providing the necessary tools rather than dictating tasks from above. Emphasizing a hands-on approach, Thomas emphasizing the servanthood leadership, signifying a commitment to serving and supporting the team. Tune in and let's get started with this fascinating discussion. Welcome to the Ecom Pulse, your heartbeat to the world of e-commerce. I'm your host, Eitan Kotter. Join us as we meet with industry leaders, marketing experts, and the innovative minds behind the tech that is shaping the e-commerce future. So plug in, gear up, and get ready for a pulse-pounding journey into the heart of e-commerce. Hello, Thomas. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Thomas. I mean, we're going to discuss an amazing topic for me and for our guest, I believe. The baby industry, baby gear, Snugglebugs, right? So, you know that I'm a father of five kids, and I've been throughout all the various shopping experiences for kids. So, okay. It's really an exciting topic for me, so I really appreciate your time. Maybe we can start by sharing the audience who you are, right, and what you're working for, and what are you doing these days. And you can start from whatever, you know, you want to start that you feel is relevant, you know, for our discussion.
Yeah, well, okay. So my name is Thomas Hamilton. I am the VP of Sales and Marketing for Snugglebugs, which is a baby retailer in Canada where we specialize in baby gear. So that'd be car seats, strollers, and then we carry a wide breadth. So we're crossing over 30,000 SKUs total. So it's a wide breadth, but there's a heavy focus on gear. Prior to that, I actually spent 10 to 12 years in the digital marketing agency world. So I sort of crossed the line to enemy side and went client after 10, 12 years of work. I had my own freelance agency for a while and worked at a couple agencies in Toronto, some top agencies there in the influencer marketing space. And sort of, it's been a wide breadth. I've done everything from working in like branding agencies to pure digital marketing acquisition plays, influencer, corporate media world, and then landed on the client side in e-commerce.
Yeah, I mean, I was really, really impressed, you know, when we chatted about and preparing for this episode, because you've started and your career revolves around the agency side, you've built projects, you've been on the technical side, then you moved to the digital marketing side. Obviously, you're heading sales and marketing activities for Snugglebugs, but you have a very solid, you know, technical, you know, foundations of everything around e-commerce and how things are evolving around that. So it's going to be really interesting discussions because you have the, you know, you have the experience on both sides of things. What made the transition to the marketing side? Why you're so passionate about it? Because you've started from, you know, the technical and more on the implementation side.
Yeah. So funny enough, I studied marketing in college. I did it exclusively as a way to try to help fund my music career. I started off planning to be a rock star as I feel like most people in a creative field do. Yeah. I thought marketing would be a good way to market myself and my music. And so I started off there, and in the process of trying to work jobs and play music and try to combine those two, I ended up falling into an interesting space where instead of taking a job, I started a landscaping company. because that I figured, oh, hey, I can have winters off. I can tour. I can work during the summer. It'd be great.
Yeah.
And part of that, I had to learn to get clients. So as a matter of just survival, I sort of jumped into the digital marketing space, which at that point was still new. Like Google Ads had only been around a couple years. Facebook Ads hadn't really started. You could still spend money on newspapers and get a fair amount of clients. And so there was this interesting separation between all the different marketing channels. And it was a great foray into how do I actually acquire clients for myself to fund my living? And that took me down a path where I was introduced to great people early on who ran digital agencies, got to work alongside as a freelancer, got to work for other landscaping type businesses and help them acquire clients. And
great. And
that just took my path in a totally different direction. As part of that, it was still early days in the web world. So I taught myself how to build websites. And the platforms that exist that are more drag and drop didn't exist. And so you had to learn to code. And I ended up doing a developer boot camp and trying to become a full stack developer and run down to help facilitate my web building. So it was sort of I feel like my career had a lot of survival elements. And how do I survive and pay? And but that's what's been so exciting is it took me from, okay, I'm going to play music and use my landscaping business to fund that to, okay, maybe I don't want to actually spend my life touring, living out of a van, playing in dive bars across the country and would instead like to have a family and a life. And so transitioning my life in a different direction. And the skills I learned to survive during the early stages of my music career were the skills that kind of propelled the rest of my career. So I worked in multiple different agencies from there, implementing my technical skills. There was also this strange period of time where every marketing agency wanted to develop tech products. Mm-hmm. I think they figured if they had their own proprietary tech, then they'd be able to sell for multiples versus, you know, just the standard 1.5. And so it was an interesting time to come into an agency as a freelancer, help facilitate the digital side. And they would ask about tech projects. Hey, we want to build this influencer identification software. And having the opportunity to go, sure, we can figure it out. And developing software and working through these big technical projects. And that happened, I would say, like 3 or 4 times with different types of software projects. And it was the kind of the confluence of that software development and then the digital marketing that brought me to e-commerce. Because fundamentally, once you know a bit of both of those things, e-commerce is this open of like, oh, okay, well, if I can help facilitate the build of a really intuitive and easy to use website and I can market it, then I can help clients grow their online businesses and expand digitally and sell digitally. So that was sort of the pathway to get to e-commerce. Yeah. And then, just over 4.5 years ago, I made the jump out of agency to client side. And that was really as a tool to be closer to my family. The business was someone I had a slight relationship with. We connected a couple times and talked through entrepreneurial networks. And I felt that at that time, it was a good move to transition. I wasn't having to go to Toronto as often. I wasn't having to go to client meetings as often and find something more local, which allowed me to be around my family that was using a first job at that time. So it was kind of an opportunity to make sure I could be close to home.
Yes, that's very, very important. I mean, e-commerce, I meet so many guests, and they're all so passionate and excited about e-commerce, right? Like, even after 2 decades in the business. And that's another nice angle, interesting angle that you've shared with us. I mean, like e-commerce actually encompasses all the great things that you did, both on the technical side, on the site building, marketing side, commerce. Everything is like concentrated in this, in our industry. And it's really fascinating to see those different backgrounds and how people are evolving in this industry. So,
And what's so cool about e-commerce versus, say, pure software is I always liked the idea that I was actually selling something.
Yes.
Like the problem with selling software and delivering it is you're sort of delivering air, this promise that this tool might do something. And it always felt very esoteric and not as tangible. So I really liked that it's like, you pay the money and then I send you the product and then you receive the product and you're happy with the product, hopefully. Which it just felt like a much fairer exchange of.
Yes, there's like there is an immediate feedback, right? And you can see. I agree. Great. So let's talk about the baby gear industry, like Canada. Sure. What's happening in the ecosystem?
Yeah. Well, Canada is actually going through a really interesting time in our baby gear industry. I would say historically, you would have a couple larger incumbents that were big box stores that sort of dominated a good percentage of the industry. And then you had smaller boutique stores spread across the country. And what I would say started happening in 2018, 2019, but really was accelerated through COVID. Canada had a very interesting COVID response. There was much tighter lockdowns than most of the world. And a lot of businesses were sort of ground down during that time. And so what seems to have happened is a lot of the big players have exited the market, or maybe because they couldn't find it to be profitable, or they just flat out went out of business. And at the same time that was happening, a lot of the smaller boutiques, which didn't have the size and scale to operate during COVID, to be able to sell online really effectively, when they lost their brick and mortar presence, they also started going under. And so there was this interesting time in the market where smaller boutique independents who had great operations and the ability to scale up quickly were able to capture market share and grow. And we were one of those organizations. And so we were able to substantially grow. I think we had 300 to 400% growth in the last 4.5 years.
Wow.
And a lot of that came through our e-commerce presence. I would say prior to COVID, we were 70% retail, 30% digital, and we've now basically inversed those numbers. That means we took the initial COVID bump and then kept building and building and building and building from there. And able to still grow our retail presence, but at the same time, really expand our digital reach.
Amazing. It proves that baby gear is like can be totally a majority online, which is not common for other industries, like maybe furniture or others that are probably 70-80% offline. It's very difficult to make the transition. Now, before COVID, when was the time that you've decided to digitize the platform, launch the platform from an offline retailer to an online?
Our organization had started digitally long before. They were actually a bit of a pioneer in the digital space. They were very quick to get online. So I think they had been selling online probably since 2010 or somewhere around there. They'd started on Magento, had built a really great platform there. When I arrived, they had just made a transition to a platform called WorkArea, which was later acquired by VTEX, for those who are familiar with the VTEX platform. When I arrived, that transition, the person who had originally planned the transition had left sort of as it was wrapping up. There was a lot of chaos and not a lot had been documented. And so it was sort of to walk in, help stabilize that transition, and then build from there. And then we spent about 3 years on that platform. It was acquired by VTEX. And at that time, we had to make a decision whether to move on to the VTEX platform or whether to make a shift. And we actually made a shift during that period to Shopify Plus after kind of evaluating the different options. So I was actually around for basically two web transitions as part of my tenure there. Wow. And there was the most explosive growth happened during the time when we were on the platform. I think that was just when we finally got the original transition completed. We'd had a lot of time to optimize and manage and build things exactly how we wanted. And then we transitioned to Shopify in July of 2023.
Wow. That's a really extensive turnaround, right? Re-platforms in this period, period of time. I guess you're now settled on Shopify Plus, so you're happy.
it's interesting because in some ways Shopify Plus is a bit of a platform downgrade from where we were. Like we were on through enterprise at the mid-market level is a bit difficult. There's not a lot of options. And so for the listeners who don't know, it's like you're at the highest level, you're going to go total custom. You might use something like Shopify for, back-end product management. But even then at wide catalogs, it's not yet there. They're introducing some updates to hopefully better facilitate wide catalogs. But fundamentally, it was designed for DTC brands with minimal SKU counts. So you can see that in its architecture and just even how it, there's little things like you don't have a sale price, you have a comparing price. So if you want to put a bunch of SKUs on sale, you need to update a compare at price and then reduce the actual price, which that from a functional workflow standpoint makes no sense. There should be a sale price and a regular price, but you can tell it wasn't put together by people who sell large amounts of SKUs online. So in some ways, the platform was a bit of a downgrade, but what's nice about it is the speed with which you can build on top of it is quick because you're not worrying about back-end database management and all the tests you need to write. So one of the benefits of moving to Shopify for us has been speed. if we can rapidly build and increase our feature count. And every platform plugs in. So historically, if we wanted to integrate, it's like, change your email provider. 3 months of build out to get the integration working correctly. It's whereas now it is, whereas now we can generally download an app and it's working.
So I mean, it's the right way to go, I guess. I mean, it's the growth, I think, is accelerated from what I'm hearing all over. There is a great rush. And the gold, I mean, people are running and replacing Magento and others, you know, with Shopify, primarily because of this reason, these reasons, right? The easy onboarding of third-party
platform. And it's not that it's a pain. It's not that it's pain, but ultimately, like, their roadmap is such that it's encouraging for bigger retailers that the options are going to be there, and they keep developing in that world. So it is encouraging. I think we looked at Shopify before making it to work area, and at that time, it wasn't an option. They didn't have the feature set for mid-market, but we're there now.
Yeah. And this is something you've built internally, or you work with some agency?
So we have a great working relationship with an agency, and so we do a mix between what we design and control and then what we need to outsource to have built. There are some things we are capable of, we would do internally, and then bigger projects and more strategic builds, we work with an agency partner who we've been working with for a number of years, and they're fantastic.
Great. So let's talk about offline, online. I mean, what are some of the offline or omnichannel consideration you took into consideration? I mean, when you launched the platform, or what are your plans towards omnichannel this year?
Yeah. So we transitioned to Shopify POS as part of the build. And one of the reasons we did this, we really wanted unity between offline data and online data. We wanted to have customer accounts that were isn't in both places, that were synced between both systems, that were updated and managed. We wanted orders to be easily recalled between the different systems with the same attributes. They're edited in retail, then they're edited on the web. So a big goal of going to Shopify was trying to unify our data. A lot of the considerations take place around fulfillment methods. So you really need to understand, like, okay, we have a pool of inventory. Some of that inventory exists in the store. Some of that inventory exists in your warehouse. So how do we separate that properly, but make it so that someone can buy online, go pick up in store, fulfill that order in store, have the fulfillment process written back correctly? There's a whole bunch of considerations in your ERP for how that's received and what that data looks like, how to differentiate between that type of an order. Then you're going to be in store and you're going to want to ship right to the customer. So they're in and say, hey, we don't have it in stock, but we can ship it to your home. Then there's a third consideration of, hey, we don't have it in stock, but we'll ship it to this store and put it on a transfer, bring it in the store, and then you can come and pick it up. So, and then also there's just flat out, hey, we can buy and leave with it today. And so how do you manage all of those different fulfillment types? That was one of the biggest considerations. And then also managing inventory, because once you're dealing with an ERP, having inventory synced correctly between your different systems can become a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
Prior to Shopify, inventory was only updated end of day. So you're selling all day through retail. Yeah. It's updated, but now you're also selling online that same retail for people to come pick up. So then you run into order cancellations and frustrating customers at the different levels. So how do you make sure that your inventory is synced, and how tightly is that synced? That also creates problems, because you have to figure out, okay, if we do a return and store of a product, it's going to go back into our inventory and our ERP. And we need to make it immediately available for sale. What's the time loop on that? Can we run different inventory syncs? They're going to bring retail only product at a different cadence than our web only inventory, because maybe we have more inventory in our web. And what does that look like? So there's just a lot of considerations for managing inventory. Selling is always part of it. How do you sell efficiently? What sort of hardware do you have? What's the sort of process for checking out? It's like extremely long queuing. How do you capture information at checkout so that you can facilitate multiple transactions while still collecting customer information so that you can have an ongoing relationship? So there was a lot of time and energy put into how do we make it more efficient? What sort of devices are we going to use, and how we set them up? So maybe the unified setup across all stores. We trained them across all stores. So it was a really exciting experience to make the transition, because there's a lot of considerations. And then there's the followed after, like, okay, well, how do we, now that we've got it implemented, we've had team members using these systems for 10 to 15 years, How are we going to retrain them? Make sure they're all educated. Yes. Everyone's onboarded. We have to have, I can't have everyone just coming to me. So no, I train people. So there's an offset of people to come and train out on how to use POS technology. So it was a really great, exciting thing.
Wow, yeah, it's nice that you say it was a great and exciting, because that's the only way to look at such a
well, it's radical terrible, process. Horrible.
I'm sure though it wasn't always, you know, exciting and happy process, right?
Yeah. No, I'm sure the team like got used to my page. Okay, so let's try plugging it in this way. Yeah, did we try resetting? We did.
We did. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Amazing. And about the inventory that you mentioned, are you managing your own inventory, or you're using some 3PLs in the business?
We are self-fulfilled. So we have our
self-fulfilled,
own
self-fulfilled. Yeah.
Warehouse. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's,
which for us has been great, because it gives us the freedom to scale up, really manage demand effectively. Like we're same day shipping most, I don't know, 99% of orders. If it comes in that day, we're shipping it out that day. There's very rare that we're actually holding orders unless there's some sort of inventory problem. There's a delayed shipment from a vendor for some reason. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, we move at a pretty fast pace and we're shipping same day. So that helps too from our selling perspective, because if a customer comes into the store and they're looking to buy something outside of the inventory in a particular store location, we can tell them like, yeah, it'll have shipped by end of day and we've been shipping. So the likelihood that it's there tomorrow or the next day is incredible.
Interesting. In terms of the buyers or the personas, obviously first time moms, right? Do you see any difference in terms of purchasing personas from offline and online?
With our consumers, it's pretty close, because what you find is a consumer who's coming to a boutique, especially a boutique like ours for baby items, they're coming for a few reasons. They're coming from an educational standpoint, and then they're also coming selection standpoint. So education, we've invested heavily. We're a content heavy organization. So we have a whole section called our learning center, which, you know, there's the traditional SEO blog that you would stick on your site. Whereas we have a full-time editor who manages a number of different writers. We're uploading at an incredibly rapid pace. This isn't sort of like a once every 3 months we throw a blog for SEO. We have a wide range of topics. We have all the way to the bottom funnel, product comparisons, sleep clinic, sleep training, everything that would affect sort of our consumer. And we sort of look at that as part of our brand promise of instilling confidence. And so we want to be able to instill confidence at all stages and for all of our customers. And so we invest heavily in content. And so we tend to see a good amount of shopping online for that content perspective. And in our, you know, NPS scores and in our review, that's the sort of information that comes back from the positives. And then I would say the type of person who goes in store is generally looking for that personalized experience. That might differ if we had wider, let's say, retail footprint. So we have locations in Ontario and BC, but there's the rest of Canada where we don't have a retail footprint. So I think you're finding the consumers are coming through for the same purposes. What you see in store more of compared to, say, online is people shopping for gifts. So they'll have a registry. They'll be like, okay, I got to go to an event. I'm going to pop into the store. It looks like they've got to pick up, talk to them, buy off the registry, and then take off. So baby registries are a large thing in Canada. And so you see a lot of grandma and grandpa, uncle and aunt, friends buying in store. And that can be a little bit different. Whereas online, a lot of the times, consumers are purchasing for themselves. So there's a bit of a differentiated behavior there. Yes. But it's still a very, like, you see a pretty cohesive experience. You'll see friends, that which is our internal name for customers, buying both online and store. And you can
Yes. And what's important for the buyers when they're, you know, sort of go through your website on your online website? What's important for them? What they're looking for? I mean, what type of purchase behaviors they have? How much they're spending, right? From searching to purchasing. What are some of those characteristics?
Well, and again, we're in a very interesting space. So typically in baby world, the process goes something. You find it. First couple months, they're adjusting to reality, waiting, telling family and friends, getting excited. And then you realize, oh, we need to buy some stuff. then you're generally going to start visiting stores, start doing your research, build a baby registry, add all your products. And from about 3 months to 9 months, when the baby comes, that 6 month window, you know, 80% of lifetime value comes from a customer. And then after that, within the following year or two, you see a few other sort of keystone purchases. But the vast majority of the purchases happen for a customer in a 6 month window. And so what happens is you're in a high intensive research stage where it sort of consumes a lot of, very similar to a lot of wedding. I think the wedding industry probably has something similar where it's like, you're not thinking about it. And then you're almost exclusively thinking about it. It's the sole focus. You're in and out of store multiple times, asking questions, testing. What about this? What about that? Not sure about that. Let's read the review. And you're also dealing with, in many cases, products. So strollers can range from $800 to $2,000. Car seats are $400 to $900. So these are expensive purchases that typically you would spend more time researching, but often against a deadline. So you don't have the year to make the decision. You don't have 8 months to make the decision. You do have generally a deadline. You want to get the products in before the baby comes too, that's the ideal, right? So you need to build your nursery, get all your products, learn how to use them, open them, make sure everything's correct. So there's this tight window where a lot of the purchasing happens. And so a good amount of our energy is put into making sure that we're available with the content and the support that customers need to be able to facilitate.
Interesting. Let's talk about some of your marketing strategies and tactics. I mean, what are you doing? Obviously, you mentioned content, so I guess you're doing a lot of inbound, but obviously you're also creating some of the outbound strategies, also paid media. Give us kind of an overview of what's working and what you're working on.
Yeah, so we're heavily investing in a lot of different digital media channels. And then we just adjust our strategy. I mean, one of the unique things about being a retailer versus, say, a direct consumer is what we're selling generally has search volume and generally has intent and desire. So we're sort of offering products that, that people have already pre-sold themselves on. They know they're going to need a stroller. They know they're going to need a car seat. They know they're going to need a snack carrier, these extended products. And they typically, once you've done a little bit of research, you become familiar with the 10 brands that you need to familiarize yourself with. And then you're buying off one of those brands. So as a retailer, a lot of what we need to position on is one, instilling confidence in that journey, making sure that we make them feel the most comfortable decision they're going to make. So that's where the content creation comes into play. So a lot of our content strategies focus around education. So that would be our YouTube channel. We're, you know, it's like we have a dedicated social team. So we have a couple of people who work on social. So we're focused across all the main channels. So you're going to see us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Pinterest. We don't, Twitter and X doesn't really play as much into our strategy, but those main content channels, you're going to see a lot of content going out. We do a lot of video, a lot of it's educational. We tend not to play in the trend space because for us, searching total, like total follower account is a bit of a misnomer for us because one, that's a staling effect. Like those followers stale at a certain point, right? Where they're no longer interested in the type of content you have. And so it can play against you if you've got a wide amount of followers that are no longer interested because it's been 2 years and they're not interested in baby anymore. They're following and then they're not watching your stuff. That's going to tank your algorithm. So there's actually a strange relationship with followers and follower growth that we because of that staling effect. So a lot of
For the intent-based followers, right? So
So for us, it's much more about education. And then the rest of it is visibility. And then you combine that with strategy. So making sure that when someone's looking to make a purchase on a particular product, that they're aware of you as a retailer, that they've seen some brand promises, and that you can promise you have the inventory, that you'll deliver it quickly, and that you'll resolve problems quickly. You can handle those and get that brand promise out while instilling confidence on the content side, then that's how you manage the retailer. Because you're not, generally, you can try and position yourself on exclusivity or we are the only ones that have these products. But fundamentally, like if you're buying a TV, there's only so many TVs you're going to buy. Yeah. And so if someone has an exclusivity on a particular brand, either they're Walmart or like where they're at that size, or it's not that great a brand, potentially. Why would they be exclusive to a, you know, a retailer? So it is the same product spread across a number of different retailers. And so we want to make sure that we've got the inventory, that we've got the great price. They got the right delivery speed so they can trust it. We got great customer service, and we can educate and make sure that friends can make the best decision for themselves. So that's generally our approach to marketing. And then we fulfill that uniquely through each channel. So video channels are going to be about education, digital paid media through, we run Pinterest ads, we run Facebook ads, I can say. We invest in commercial listings. So we play in all those spaces, but for us there, it's about visibility and making sure that we capture the eyeballs and then making sure the site is set up correctly to convert with the inventory.
And are you taking a closer look or further analysis into those paid media channels? I mean, do you have any, how do you analyze the data of what's working, what's not, or it's not that any priority, right?
Yeah, well, I don't know how you feel about GA4, but I haven't talked to a single person that likes it yet.
Yes, yes.
So we use a number of different things. For on-site, we're going to use heat mapping, video recordings. We use GA4 for tracking. We have investigated looking at an attribution tool. So I know there's a number of them out there. We looked at Triple Whale, like North, Emotive, and a few others. We've been looking at that space. We haven't yet pulled the trigger on committing to it because we felt to date where we can, between all the different activities that we're doing, we can get what we need. And so it's more of a simplification process. Now, I could be wrong. So if you're out there and you hear this and you want to sell me, I'm happy to jump on a call. But largely, that's how we do it. We have a person dedicated on our team who looks at media, looks at data, who's always evaluating the different channel performances and then comparing them relative to sales. Because I'm sure you're aware, it's like if you added up all the money that each platform tells you, you're making five times more.
Yes.
Ahead of budget from where you are. So how do you differentiate and do the deep diving? And so that we've typically done through on-platform analytics, Google Analytics. Then we're using on-site tools for measuring the heat map. Just trying to gather all that and pull it together.
Yeah. So obviously there is a demand, right? People need baby gear, right? And then they've centered around various products that they want after they did some research, and then they need to make the selection where to purchase.
Yeah.
So you're trying to have one, the inventory to be available, right? Support them in the sales process, have an amazing customer support, anything that you want to add that maybe is a differentiator for Snugglebugs that you want to mention.
Well, you need to have the catalog breadth. So if you have 55 or 60% of what someone's looking for, then they want to make a single purchase or they want to build a registry. Uh-huh. Most of the time, they're looking to reduce complexity. So you need to have a wide breadth of products. Mm-hmm. And this is where things get a little bit interesting because you're going to have your products, let's say your top 1,000 SKUs that sell, you can see the constant movement. And then after that, it starts getting tough to decide or to discover what's actually selling. Because once something's selling ones and twos and small quantities, it's difficult to suss out that was what really moved the needle for a consumer. But part of it is ensuring that if you're a retailer, you can widen. There seems to be a very strong correlation between catalog size and sales. Mm-hmm. Because if someone's looking for that one specific item or that one specific item, when you're able to sell it. But what's difficult is understanding what to bring in and when to bring it in. So I think we need to be in the process of how can we continue to expand our catalog? How can we buy appropriately so we've got an ever-expanding catalog that continues to grow as the biggest offering, while at the same time focusing in on they're not sitting too long, that we're not carrying that inventory, that we're not stuck blowing it out later and losing money. So there's a fine balance. I would say that's a huge part of it. If you're going to be selling as a retailer, you need a wide catalog. And then you need to be able to facilitate the transactions quickly. You need to be able to, someone processes an order, it needs to ship out very fast. And people should be saying, wow, I got it faster than Amazon, because that's very possible. It's not it's not difficult actually to keep up with their speed as long as you've got the right process. So when they show up at your site, they need an easy to use site. It's easy to navigate. So you need to have great search, especially if you've got a wide catalog. So you can't have search be this inconsistent part. You can't be relying on default search. You need to be monitoring and optimizing it daily. You need to be looking at all the different ways that you can redirect on-site search consistently to well-merchandised catalogs that are merchandised not just based on default sorts or not just based on price high low, but like there's an intelligence placed behind your merchandising and what you're placing where to product listing pages that have the information that dictates all the different pieces of the product, not just a brief little description, but like you give all the elements that someone would want. Because yes, only 25% might get down there, but those 25% are the ones who are serious and looking to buy. Yeah. And then you need to be able to facilitate that transaction and ship it out quickly with reliable carriers at a reliable speed so that people can trust when they buy from you that they're going to get what they want, comes exactly as described, and it'll come quickly, and they can always find what they're looking for. Yeah. So for us, getting all of those things together is the success. And then if you run great marketing and you have effective paid media, you bring enough traffic to your site, and then you have the tools in place.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you've experienced substantial growth, right, during the last few years. And I'm very, very interested in the team building, you know, the culture, sure. your management style, what it looks like and how you manage to grow also with, you know, people during this period.
Yeah, it's something I'm really passionate about. I think, you know, being in the tech world and being in the tech industry, what can become a default answer is automation. And so a lot of the times when you speak with people, it's like, oh, let's get an app. Let's get this. We'll automate it. And what I have found is the problem with automation is it generally robs you of the resources to solve big problems.
Yeah.
Because automation is great for solving preset problems. But what happens if you have, let's say you have a Black Friday sale and you're going to move 1,000 of something and they ship out with the wrong tax code? Mm-hmm. Like, and it's now we're talking hundreds of thousands of and missing.
Yes.
It's like, okay, well, if you don't have bodies and you don't have humans to actually reach out and try and solve these problems, and you're relying on using automation, then you don't have the workforce necessary to solve that problem.
Yes.
And, you know, yeah, you could argue, well, you can use automation to get ahead of these problems. Like, nope, these problems come up. When you're selling at scale, when you have wide products and you're selling at high volume, it's not a if something's going to happen, it's what is going to happen, what is going to go wrong. I like telling teams before every big sale, it's like, something's going to go wrong. We don't know what yet, but when it does, our goal is to react swiftly. We're not going to play blame game. We're not going to say, well, so it's like, no, that's helpful. We're just going to solve the problem because every big event, something will go wrong and it'll be a big deal. It's going to require a lot of attention and focus. So all that to say, like, automation is important, and obviously it can save a lot of time. It can help enhance your teams. But one of the things I learned very early on is that you need, one, to look to people solve a problem first, not automation first. Because when you have people and you have the appropriate people in the right job and you're resourced enough, then you can solve problems outside of just their day-to-day operations. There's a great Rory Sutherland talks about the doorman fallacy. Are you familiar with that?
Well,
so the idea is that you have this high end hotel and it's coming along. You have a doorman. They open the door. They greet the guests, and then you bring in a consulting firm. Consulting firm is like, how we're going to optimize costs, and they basically apply a job set to the doorman. It's like, oh, the doorman opens the door, greets guests. Well, what we can do is get rid of the doorman. We'll put an automated door that opens and closes, and it'll be a great experience. It'll save tons of money over the long term in the salary. Well, 3 years later, what they found is guest satisfaction is down. The doors that are open, now you've got people sleeping in the middle of the night in between the two door sets. And you're also noticing that the overall quality of guests that are coming to the hotel has gone down. What happens is you realize that the doorman served a number of functions that were job description specific, like they were part-time security. They actually added to the fact that you had a doorman, added to the prestige of the hotel, such that when people came, like, oh, this is the place that you would spend a bunch of money because you have this doorman. The doorman was great at making recommendations. The guest satisfaction was higher. People liked being greeted. And so there's all these intangibles that were tied to this particular role that you then automate out. Part of the digital world is understanding or at least trying to identify what those are in a particular role. So for customer service, it's like, it is actually helpful to have somebody walk through and identify all the overdue orders and send out manual emails versus automating it, because there's so many different tasks that person also gets used for. And at the same time, the ability to personalize each one of those emails, the ability to then create follow-ups, to then see an immediate email, like, well, actually, hold on, before I just send this from an automated system, I know that shipment's landing today. I'm going to go back and talk to the will in the warehouse, and we're going to get that SKU received in a little bit quicker so we can get it shipped out today before the end of shipping deadline. Like, you have all of those, let's call them advancements at your fingertips. But if you're just running an automated system for every single thing that you do, you miss it. Yeah. And so it's, to be honest with you too, often it's not even cheaper to do automation. Like, anyone who's run at enterprise level, you know, every tool you want to install is like $3,000 a month US minimum to get these tools installed. It's like for minimum wage or like slightly above, even if you pay slightly above minimum wage, 20, 30% above minimum wage labor in some of these roles, you can get a lot of hours that you can offer remote working positions for, make them feel incredible, give them awesome working culture and environment that they're then dedicated to show up and do a great job. And you would get way more labor for that money. And on top of that, you would be able to use them in a number of different ways. So there's this scaling effect of, okay, we've got labor that can now do 10 things versus resources that are tied to one specific task.
Yeah.
I find that's what happens with a lot of automation. You get stuck to these tools do one or two things kind of okay, but you need a couple others to try and fill in the gaps. And by the time you get through adding all these platforms together, you could have just brought on a number of good people. And even if it's in part-time capacity, working 20 hours a week, 18 hours a week, 12 hours a week, and split these tasks across. And yes, that's more management of the people. But you're going to spend that much time fixing whatever's wrong with your automated software anyways and on tech support. And now you have people that you can scale up and down in their hours and also facilitate a number of other tasks. So for us, that was a huge part of our growth. It started in customer service. It really moved up to the warehouse quickly, where we developed this concept of the flex force, which is using people in flexible hours. You know, it's partly a rebranding of part-time, but the fundamental truth was we looked at it differently. It's like, hey, your mom whose kids are at school, you don't work full-time, you're just looking to get out of the house for a few hours a week, you're willing to work like 2 4-hour shifts between 10 and 2, and it's like, we'll take that.
Yeah,
come on in, we'll find great, we'll put you to work. They show up, they work incredibly hard for the time they're there, they're happy to be there, and then they go. And it's like, if we have to manage more of those people, that's okay. That just requires having good people managers, not technical managers, the top teams, and then manage those resources effectively. And what you find is there's a lot of people who would be willing to do something like that. They show up, they're great workers, highly capable team members, and so they can do more tasks. And then when life changes and there's an opportunity, they're willing to work more hours or maybe move up into a different part of the organization. So you also create this feeder for the rest of your organization with highly capable people who are willing to move up, but maybe at this given time, they're not. They're like, isn't permitted. And so we tried to not get bogged down by like, okay, we got to get 5 people at 40 hours a week, and this is what they do. It's like, well, maybe it's better to have 12 people, and we split that resources across 12 people. Yeah, the people manager has to do more hours management, but that's why we hire them. So, like, and that's what they're there for. Yeah. So it's a little bit more of a pain for scheduling, but what we're able to do when we have all those extra resources way outweighs the inefficiency in scheduling.
Yes, yes. I really like this approach. Yeah, I really like it. Yeah. And I know you are also highly female-driven staff as well, which is also...
there's like 4 guys in all of them. There's like me, the owner, and 2 others. So yeah, it's
that's
a very...
That's the other side of diversity, right?
So. Yeah. We score very high.
We score very high, yeah.
Well, and then the other thing, just to add to that, is like once you get all of that understanding in place, like not diving into automation, you look at hiring first. I would say the next piece is understanding how to manage culture and recognize like how you actually empower your people leaders to distribute culture. Like, we're guided by a pretty strong set of core values. So we have 4 core values, and then we actually hire, and all of our questions are based against our core values. So everything for us is like from the hiring down to the management is tied to core values. We build quarterly goals or core values. We build everything that we do in alignment with those core values. But the way to manage that is also making sure that when you hire people, it's not this like corporate, here's a moniker that sits on a wall and here's our core values, and we cite them like a cultish chant. It's more about finding people who embody those naturally and then putting leaders in place who understand that as a leader, their job first and foremost is to lead people and manage the people effectively. And so we hire for that more than just hiring for a specific skill. So I always look at, like, if someone's going to be managing a team, the second that they're managing a team, the most important piece is that they understand people. I want someone slightly extroverted who wants to be around people, who likes people, who spends their time, is willing to, like, hop on a call with their team members, not hide behind an email or hide behind a Teams chat. So we want people leaders who really love being around people. And we want to give them the freedom to empower their team to go out and do great work. And we look at it as, like, our job as leaders is to get rid of roadblocks, to open up the path and make sure that our team members have the tools necessary. Their job is not to enforce dictates down from above. Yeah. So very hands-off in that way with my team. I like them to be able to lead the work, and they tell me what they're working on. And I view my job as to be, I call it, like, servanthood leadership. Like, my job is to serve. I'm here to help you do your job. So you tell me what it is we're working on, because I put you in the place so I can trust that you're able to do the work and that you have better ideas than I do on this work. And so if that's the case, then my job should be helping you do that and facilitating that work, not being focused on, like, what is my grand vision that I want to distill down. It's like, no, I want bottom-up leadership. I want people to come to me with the great ideas and tasks. If there's something I disagree with, we can argue it out a little bit. And maybe, you know, maybe there's times where I need my plan to move forward. But fundamentally, it should be, how do I help you do your job? And how do I become a facilitator of your work, rather than being focused solely on just issuing edicts from above?
Yeah. And actually, this creates a foundation for creativity, right? Bottom up, which is very, very powerful. By the way, you're hiring, because I think many, many people will be interested.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So we follow a couple different processes. My HR manager, I'm forgetting the name, but we look at it like this. We have right seat, right fit approach. And so we have our four core values. So great is just the beginning, uncompromising commitment to excellence. We love people and courageous integrity. So those are our four core values. And we write our interview questions for each role in alignment with those four core values to make sure that the person that we're hiring is in alignment just naturally with who they are. We then score their answers to each question and then give, like, a right fit, right seat across all of the questions. We compare all candidates. We rank order them to look at, like, okay, how did this candidate score on these different questions? What was their total score? And then we try to use that to help us find the best candidate. And then we try to layer on top of them the, like, feelings and vibes. Right? Like, because you also, like, I always tell my team, like, you want to, if you can, you should like working with the people you work with. We spend too much time here to just be around miserable people. And one really high performer who's a bit of a jackass, like, fundamentally, they kill the whole team because no one wants to work around them. No one's happy. It's like, yeah, they might be a high performer, but they're making everybody miserable. So their little bit of increase in work is way outweighed by all the people who are working less and trying to hide work and not get anything done. And so we want people that we enjoy working with. And so we shouldn't come to work and be expecting a battle with coworkers. So so it's the four question, well, the four core values, generally a couple questions per core value. And even if it's a technical job, it's like, okay, let's ask a technical question in alignment with our core values. And then we will score each question on a ranking of 1 to 5. And then we will add up all the numbers at the end. And then we have a few also additional qualifying questions for us, like, do we believe this they gets it, wants it, you know, is going to be able to show up and do it. And so once we've ranked all that, that gives us a score for each of our candidates. Same questions too, so it keeps it nice and fair across the board. And then we can use that to advance people to the next stage. I usually do a final interview, which is just a culture fit. So I'll bring them in and a couple people that they'll be working with, and it's like, let's chat. And then that'll be the final piece of, like, okay, by this point, we've already determined that you can do the job and you'd be a great fit. And so how do we just determine that you're going to get along with everybody here?
Yeah. Wow, it was very, very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. Right, it's really also exciting to see and learn about this process. Thomas, we are at the fun fact part of the episode.
Okay.
I know you started with trying to be a musician, so
yes,
I don't know, maybe
more that's usually fun the facts, one I can please. Lead with.
More fun facts.
More fun facts. Well, in high
school, otherwise you have to sing. So
I can pull the guitar real quick. Yeah. So in high school, I swam competitively and set a regional record in stroke and went all the way to Oslo for the third fastest time in the country. So
amazing.
At one point, I was a swimmer, and then, you know, I got older, and now the fitness has changed a little bit. But yeah, I was a dedicated high school. So I had that cap. I had the tight bathing suit. We were shaving. It was great. It was a good time. Yeah, competitive
nice,
swim.
Nice. Great, Thomas. Anything else you want to add?
No, I think you asked one question at the beginning. It's like one thing I'm proud of in the career. And I would say it was my change in approach to leadership and understanding what leadership meant. I think for a long time, I was under the belief that like leadership meant that you were exclusively a person of expertise, that you could then send down what you were looking for, and those people would just demand those things. Mm-hmm. You have Conrad Black refers to your subordinates would respond to you.
Yes.
And so the change for me was coming to understand that leadership is about serving. You're serving your staff. In a way, you work for them just as much as they work for you. And when you come along with some people and you act as a facilitator for them, you'll see the best work come out. And if you can encourage them to do the same, and you can train your leaders to act as facilitators, to act as roadblock removers, and really as like the servant leadership, what you'll find is that staff is happy. People are excited to come to work because they feel like they've got ownership. They feel like they're supported. They feel like they're cared for. And they're willing to do the hard work that you need to have an organization grow, especially one like ours, expanded so much. I mean, my team went from like 2 to 40 to 100. It's a wow. Huge growth cycle.
Yeah.
The only way to do that is to really invest in great leaders who train great team members and then ensure that culture persists and then be dogmatic about enforcing it. And if you see a little bit of micromanagingness kicking in, like coming down on your leaders and saying like, hey, why are you doing this? Why are you involved? Mm-hmm. You don't need to be in this. There's these details. You need to be out of it. And so I would say that's something I'm very I think that all leaders need to understand is like you're better served as a servant and as a facilitator than you are as an emperor or, you know, influencer in your own.
But that's probably easier said than done, right? You need to have like a no ego type of person.
Yeah, a little bit of humility, right?
A little bit of humility, yes. And then, I mean, it's not common to find, right, these days. So really appreciate, all the knowledge. It was really interesting to talk to you because we can talk like deep dive on almost every topic in the ecosystem, both on the technical side, staff, growth, marketing. So well done on your career. Really amazing. And for the great, great job that you do, wish you all the best and great 2024 and hope to see you soon. Thanks a lot, Thomas.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Your support means the world to us. If today's episode has been insightful for you, consider sharing it with someone who would also benefit. Even one share can make a big difference. Looking to elevate your e-commerce game? Discover Vimi, a multi-channel e-commerce platform that will transform your business with the power of shoppable video. Visit us at vimi.net to learn more. It's Vimi, V-I-M-M-I.net. Thank you for being part of our journey. Stay tuned for more invaluable insights in our next episode.